This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 287 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Now, while we don't have any formal sponsors this week, our discussion, or at least Ginger's half of the discussion, and I haven't started yet, will be partially brought to you by Blair Athol Highland Single Malt Scotch Whiskey from the 12-year. We got it on our first ever Pod Abroad, on the first ever Pod Abroad, Outlander-themed tour of Scotland, so 2018. And trying to find, like, I just read the name. I'm trying to find out how big the bottle is. Just say, oh, 20 centiliters. So it's a fifth. I guess you call it a fifth. It's a fifth of a liter. Anyway, it's not the teensiest bottle they had, but I mean, it's definitely not like a normal big size bottle.
It's larger than I would have purchased.
Well, that's true. And the reason I got it, because I don't normally bring back whiskey from Scotland. I know it's expensive to get it here, but it's a lot to also bring it on the plane and worry about it breaking. The reason I don't bring stuff home is, well, for those reasons. The reason I got this was because outside of, like, what is it, 90-something percent of all of this stuff that they produced went to, like, their parent company that went into other blends. The only places you can get the single malt of Blair Athol was there at the distillery, or, like, in two places. It was, like, Switzerland and Japan or something. So not in the U.S., basically. Mm. And it's not bad. I like it, but it's not something I would necessarily, you know, go to a restaurant and try and order, like, something that tastes like it. I would try and order anyway. But since it was something that was not easily findable, gettable.
But does it taste like memories? No, what is wrong with you? I said, does it taste like memories? Like, do you taste it and, like, are you back in Scotland from the tour?
Girl, I taste almost any. Hold on. I had a halfway committed cat. She wanted on my lap, but she knows when I record or edit, if you want to be with mama, you got to be in the pouch. It doesn't take me back there, but I mean, I remember my taste of it. It was interesting. It's a cute little thing. It's nothing I'm going to, like, have a ton of, because, you know, it's a special bottle and I don't think we're going back there this year. We're going to a different distillery. So I definitely want to keep it, you know, for special occasions. Okay, hold on. The cat's back. Are you going to come see me? Come here, love. Hi. Hey, come here. Hey. Oh. So I'm going to try and have a little bit of, ooh, my throat's already like, I respect you. So we got the announcements. I'm sorry, the intro. Do we have any announcements?
No.
Except that earlier today, we were having a kind of a funny discussion about the Shimmerin Toits, and Summer had a very interesting idea. Summer said, please, can we make, what did you say?
Can we get a fake movie poster made?
Oh my gosh. So
it like Toots and Shimmerin Toots and have it look like a buddy cop movie.
I am happy to have that done as long as my likeness is not on it. You can use like an outline of two people. I don't care. But anyway,
no,
I think
I
that's
want
funny.
Our faces on there with like our headphones.
Oh, well then, no. Oh, with our headphones. And our mics instead of guns.
Uh-huh.
You're too funny. So that's the announcement. It's not an announcement, but
it's not an announcement because we didn't.
I know.
We're not planning on doing
funny,
it. We just
though.
Talked about it, but that's not an announcement.
I know.
You're really bad at this.
I know. That's why you do it. So that's the announcement section. Go on, Summer. Shimmer.
This is the worst announcement section ever. All right. This week, let's go back. And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along. with chapter 3 entitled Bilious Humors.
And a few more chapters too.
Yeah, we're starting with it.
In chapter 2, Abel McLennan had shared his very sad account of a loss of his wife and family. Chapter 3 begins at the end of the same breakfast. Let's check in. We're still on the last day of the gathering.
Get comfortable, guys. We're not going anywhere.
Very comfortable. And now the mood is, well, I was like, it's a downer, but the mood is gone. Well, I don't know what the mood was, but it's a downer. People have kind of gone their own ways. Everybody effed off, and Brianna showed up to help her mom with the morning clinic. Claire lovingly recalls the day before when she caused contagious vomiting with the debriding of a dude's wound. It was, in quote, sympathetic reflex of said dude. I just got a nightmare vision. I have never done that, but it would not surprise me if...
Sympathetically vomiting?
Yes.
So like Stand By Me?
Maybe.
Do you remember the movie Stand By Me? Mm-hmm. When they go to the guy goes to a pie eating contest. He enters a pie eating contest, but he drinks Ipecac beforehand. Mm. So he goes into the pie eating contest. So midway through the pie eating contest, the one dude just starts puking. Like Gross. Projectile vomiting everywhere. And then everyone else starts projectile vomiting. And so it just becomes this giant vomit scene. If you've seen Stand By Me, you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. That's what I'm suggesting happened.
Oh, I understand what you're saying. And I vaguely remember the scene. Like I'm having flashes of it. But I don't want to really think about sympathetic reflex vomiting. Because
that could be the Blair Athol talking. Oh,
I've had literally like barely a sip. Gracious.
You're lightweight.
I mean, that is not untrue, but I haven't had enough to make me my alcohol.
Don't it make your lightweight
show? Yes. So even though it's her wedding day, Brianna is going to help her mom. Diana gives us an eye into the suffering of the people, and of course, through Claire. Claire has the ability to detach herself. She has a flash of the time she was in France during World War II. And so she understands the necessity, especially understands the necessity of separating yourself or distancing yourself emotionally, detaching yourself so you can actually treat the person there.
Hold on, baby.
Go see me.
Can you hold on?
There's a girl. Oh, good girl. Are you going to sit with me now? Good girl.
That is a good baby.
Okay. We're not going to use the R word. And I know it was of the time, blah, blah, blah. But we'll say developmentally challenged. Brianna asks her mom about an erection? Interaction. The day before, there was a woman with a child who was, shall we say, developmentally challenged or delayed.
Syphilitic.
She didn't know that. She asked her mom about a boy who was developmentally delayed or in some way. And she says, you were telling her perhaps not to have any more children. And she's like, what is this? And Claire said, it was an inheritable condition and it was congenital syphilis. Yes, so it was syphilitic. So Claire asks Bree, you don't think Roger is syphilis, do you? She's curious why it comes up. And Bree is not happy with the question, but she was trying to go in for, she was asking about contraception. So they have that chat a little bit. Quote, women in the Indies use half a lemon, unquote.
Could you imagine?
I don't even know what you do with it.
How big are these lemons?
I mean, are they supposed to be shoved somewhere?
That's my assumption. A half a lemon.
Literally, what the hoo-ha? That would hurt.
So either, well, you just need to loosen up a little bit.
A lemon?
But I'm half of one.
Yeah, but it still doesn't change the circumference. Unless you do it long ways, I guess.
My first question is, how big are the lemons in where did you say, India?
Indies.
In Indies. How big are the lemons in the Indies? Are they small lemons? Are they
I thought
like,
you're
going to
say, how big
ones,
are the women?
Or are they big
ones? That's not appropriate.
Nope. Lemons. And the second question just being, that's... I don't know if that's a terrible reflection upon the looseness of the women or the smallness of the men, that there's room for a half a lemon, if that
makes
sense. I
wonder if you use the other half for a drink.
Before or after?
Probably before, because you need to lube up, not down there. Not down there. in your veins. So before
you, I mean, you don't have to.
It helps sometimes.
But maybe you do to get a half a lemon up there.
Stop it. Before they leave to go to the place, the clearing where they're going to have the surgery clinics that day, Claire almost forgets her medicine pouch with Nyawini's amulet. And that inspires her to mention another option. She tells Brianna, we don't get the name of it, but it's something that may or may not, hint, hint, play out later on as far as what Claire tries or is able to at least attempt to help to give Brianna later on. So seeing the amulet and putting it on reminds her something that something that Nyawini had said, that there were women's herbs, and it was a flowering plant, but the part that of the plant that you used as some kind of contraception was a type of seeds. So something is definitely up with Brie. At first, it comes out that she's a little bit worried maybe that she might have, from Bonnet, some type of VD. And I love the fact that because of Claire's era and even Brianna's era, it's still called VD because it went from VD to STD to STI. And the reason I'm so happy it's called VD is because there's a song.
Mm-mm. Please don't.
Before you fellas leave for overseas. I won't do all of it. You've got to know your secret enemies. Where duty makes us say these fears we must convey to each and every one of you today. Okay. Not every miss is like your sis. In every deck, there's a joker. So don't waste a chance on quick romance. You don't want to dance the VD polka. Okay. The funny part, though, is you've been warned by Mickey Mouse of the girls who walk the streets, the dangers of the body house and sneaky spirochete. So no, go slow, mister. You've got to go slow and resist her. Okay. Anyway, there's much more of that. That is from the musical Over Here, another high school opportunity that I had. So much fun. I believe you can Google that or YouTube Google that, Over Here. And it was starring, it was literally on Broadway in the 70s, starring the Andrews sisters and the dude from Saturday Night Fever.
He wasn't starring. He was in it.
John Travolta. So anyway, if you go check it out, I will try, as I go back through this and edit, I will look for the link, and I will also try to find a list, a link to the lyrics. It is hysterical. So Claire assures Brianna, you don't have anything, and yes, I know I said that women are typically less symptomatic than men. We would have known something by now, because Roger would either come see me, or you would have known something because of your intimacy with Roger. So Roger's fine. And Jem's okay too. So it doesn't seem to be, although it was a question she had or a concern she had, Claire still thinks that there's something kind of bothering or something getting at Brianna. She doesn't know exactly what it is, but she doesn't think the question or their conversation has ended this discussion, but she is not going to push it. So she'll say, well, you know, when something comes up, she'll let me know.
Hey, Ginger, he played Misfit. I don't know who that was.
Oh, was that the drummer?
No, I think that was Utah, wasn't it?
Oh, maybe. You weren't even in the show. Summer knows.
No, but I saw it.
I know.
Every
Summer's
night.
Like, I saw it 87 times. So we also learn, thank you, Diana Gabaldone. We get a lot of great vocabulary from Diana, some huge dollar, $5, $10, $100 words. And then we get things like the squitters, which was deadly. And it was uncontrollable diarrhea. And you're welcome.
I question Claire's assuredness that Brie has no STDs.
Because she couldn't do like a blood sample?
Yeah, I'm like, that's there. I mean, I can't prove it either way, but I don't think that technically she can either. Not everything is visible by outward appearance, and not everything gets passed on to the kid. Mm. You know what I mean? So she could have something festering down there. You don't know. I don't think Claire knows.
Well, Claire hasn't. Yeah, let's. Yeah. So Claire is led to think about the reasons Brianna's asking about contraception and disease, etc. And she wonders, she wonders if Brianna is, she wonders about children or more children. And she wonders about the possibility of, you know, when Jem no longer needs her physically to help raise him, you know, she could she could go back with Roger to their own time. And then she also thinks, well, if she has more children, that means she's stuck back here longer. So it definitely is not just about, you know, having another kid to have a for sure Roger kid. There's a lot of stuff.
But let's talk about that a little bit more. Because do you honestly think that if Jem got old enough and didn't quote unquote need her anymore, that she and Roger were just going to leave?
I will put it this way. I don't believe so. But I have to say, I was a little bit surprised that, not surprised that Claire would entertain the thought that they could go back, like physically, especially once her true responsibility to her child was, you know, for the most part covered. At least, you know, his being a true child, he'll always, Jem will always be their child. But as far as him being a child, you know, underage, et cetera, and truly needing family around, his parents around.
Mm-hmm.
But I am kind of surprised, not that she had the thought, but surprised that she seemed to not. Yeah. So she either seemed to think that it would be so easy for Brianna to. Yeah, that was kind of, it was an interesting thought.
But think about it. It's one thing to leave your adult daughter in the future where there's no saying what may or may not happen. It is quite another thing.
And to where you have your healthcare and perhaps, all that.
Right. Where you have and all the modern conveniences.
Exactly.
But it's another thing to leave your quote unquote adult, any child, male or female, in the past. And you know exactly what happened in that area during that time period. So what, you're going to leave and just hope for the best? Well, hopefully he's on the right side. Hopefully he's not one of the masses that doesn't make it through that other skirmish.
Or hopefully he's not conscripted. Exactly.
I can't even. My mom dar just like.
It was interesting.
Jumped out of there.
So what do you guys think? Is Claire like just thinking too quickly? Do you think she thinks too easily about Brianna leaving?
You know what, though? That could definitely be a strike against her character, not against her character. I'm not saying she's a bad character, but just because a lot of people, maybe not a lot, some people complained about Claire leaving her kid in the future and going back. So I'm like, is that a character flaw that she's like, well, I did it. Why wouldn't she do it?
I understand what you're saying. I wouldn't say flaw. I would say, is it a Claire thing that she's like, look, I did it. And yeah, I mean, it was hard. It's going to be hard to leave. Whatever the reason, it was not easy for her to leave Brianna, but she did leave her. However, I think maybe because she did it, maybe she therefore, it's in her psyche now. You know what I mean? It's in her makeup. So maybe she doesn't think it'll be easy for Brianna, doesn't assume Brianna will do it, but the thought that she might or could is definitely among the realm of in the realm of possibility. It's very interesting. Huh. So Murray, the other surgeon, the guy who sets up a clinic next to her, has set up his office.
This is funny. Oh, I enjoyed this a lot.
And his current client clearly has liver issues. And Murray calls it bilious humors. Claire goes over to offer her professional opinion, and she starts to tell the man of his symptoms, which were correct. And she is impressing them. Bree's like, mother. Bree's a little embarrassed. You start to get an idea of how Bree felt when her mom would come to school and start talking about stuff.
Well, it's true, but let's also consider the circumstances. It's one thing to help somebody who comes to you looking for help. It's quite another to poach a patient or attempt to poach a patient, because that's what the other dude thinks she's doing.
Well, yeah. And I don't think Claire at first even thinks about patient poaching. I think she's just trying to show off.
She doesn't think
about a lot. I know.
And you should just stop there, because she doesn't always think.
I think Bree is embarrassed because her mom went over to the other guy's area and is basically showing off. She couldn't help. The problem is, I mean, that's a problem. That's one thing. The interesting, sad thing part of it is that it's not as if Claire, even by getting the correct diagnosis, it's not as if she can do anything. This guy's life was not going to be changed. And so that was the unfortunate part. So Bree, very cleverly, under the guise of a blessing, takes Murray's blade away from him. She's like, you can't stop the guy from treating him, but you can at least try and influence his use of that blade and maybe save the dude's, save the dude who has liver issues from a horrible infection.
From dying from something else, yeah.
More quickly and more painfully, and others who would come after him from that die from that blade. So she takes the blade from Murray, puts it in the almost boiling water, and says a long drawn out blessing of Saint Michael, waiting for the water to boil. And after she takes it out and hands it over to him, it's funny that she does this whole thing, you know, it is very, very clever. And Claire tells him, you can repeat that, but don't touch the blade before you use it. And you can repeat the blessing after every use, but it only works in boiling water. I thought that was pretty clever. And Brie gets an A for performance. And Claire is reminded, although we don't know if the guy is going to get, he's already sick. We don't know if Murray will repeat that theater, those dramatics. Probably not to that extent. We don't even know if he'll do the blessing. We don't know if he'll boil anything ever. But it was worth a chance. It was worth taking the chance. However, Claire is kind of taught a lesson, like, you know, stay in your own lane, and don't try and get out of, you know, there are patients here for you. You don't need to go elsewhere and think a little bit. Think, because if you had thought about it, you may not have interrupted because you would have realized that you couldn't have helped the guy anyway before you opened your mouth. And she remembers one of the strongest tenets that was taught to her in the field hospital in France during World War II was treat the patient in front of you. So she does. Lorraine B. writes, in typical Granger fashion, the chapter title is represented in two ways. The first relates to how some of the characters are feeling. Lizzie wilting in the absence of Private Ogilvy, Claire and Brianna feeling queasy with remembrance of the previous day's chain reaction vomiting, Brie feeling troubled about contraception and having VD, and Claire feeling guilty that she couldn't do more for her patients. The second relates to Murray McLeod's assertion that his patient suffered from bilious humors and Claire humorously, internally agreeing. I love how the chapter opens with the mother-daughter closeness and humor while Claire and Brianna prepare for the morning surgery, despite the serious topics of VD and contraception. We learn from Claire that Brie is empathetic and sensible. I don't think we've seen an example of Brie's crippling empathy yet, but we have seen her empathy toward Lizzie's father in taking Lizzie on as a servant and her, possibly flawed, sensibility when she went back in time without telling Roger. What we do see in this chapter is Bree's quick and sensible thinking when Claire wants to prevent Murray McLeod from treating his patient with a dirty phleem, but has no idea how to do it. With much flourish and aplomb, Brie creates a charm, drawing heavily on Gaelic prayers that ends with her plunging the phleem into boiling water. The chapter is bookended with mother and daughter helping each other out.
And that was chapter 3. Moving along to chapter 4. Entitled Wedding Gifts.
In case you've forgotten or didn't realize, we're still on the same day. Roger's got business to the Tinker's Wagon to get a small wedding gift for something for Brianna. He really wanted to get her his own ring, but that was not going to happen. Brianna was happy with Black Brian's ring. Of course, Jamie's father. Quote, she was a pragmatic person, sometimes dismayingly so, in contrast to his own romantic streak. Unquote. He thought, a painted chamber pot? Yeah, that's great. He had a memory of a Mrs. Abercrombie, whose husband she tried to kill over the gift of an iron on an anniversary, as an anniversary present. I mean, that is kind of funny.
But he meant well.
Oh, yes. So now Roger is determined to do something romantic. He's like, F it. Yes, I can't get a lot, but this is my one and only, knock on wood, wedding day, after all. He sees Duncan Innes wearing the red Cameron tartan, and Duncan wants a word. So he says, so walk with me. We find out that Duncan Innes is Presbyterian too, like Roger. And of course, he is meant to wed Jocasta. And neither Jamie nor Jocasta know this. Not the wedding, but the Presbyterian part. Hearing Jamie's response to Roger's being a Presbyterian probably made Duncan have thoughts. But Duncan had been to see the priest to kind of get checked out or to make sure everything was okay. Roger asks him if he'd been baptized Romish. And I thought, that's not a it's not a baptism. I mean, you can be baptized in the Catholic Church, just like you can be baptized in a Protestant church, Protestant denomination. But if you are Protestant and you, someone who is Protestant and who has been baptized, wants to become Catholic, you do not get rebaptized. That is not a thing. There is such a thing called conditional baptism, but that's, I wouldn't say frowned upon. It is
conditional. It's conditional.
Yes, I know that. But it's not something that is, it's done, let's say, a lot. If you, however, if you are Protestant, but you have not been baptized, because many, if not most, Protestant denominations do not practice infant baptism, then, and you want to convert, then you absolutely will be baptized because you won't have been baptized at all yet. Anyway, just to throw that in there, just for funsies. And I wrote that down, or I mean, that came out of my head, but I wrote a little bit of that down, but Roger actually clears that up. So Roger, in his listening to Duncan, he kind of thinks to himself like, well, wait, would I have done this? And he realizes that, you know what, to be with Bree, if that's what it would have taken, he most likely would have converted to marry Bree. And Roger spells it out correctly. He says, they don't baptize you if you've already been baptized. There is no Romish baptism per se. Anyway, Roger tells Duncan that after thinking about it, he's like, you know, if you haven't already said something, don't worry about it. He's like, it's not a mass, so you're not getting, you know, there's no communion. You're not going to be like denying something, or you're not going to be taking something and in the eyes of the church committing a sin, or denying something and not taking something, which would make it you stand out. It's only a marriage service, so you're really kind of golden. And he realizes that his own situation is actually quite parallel to that of Duncan's. Quote, a penniless man without property marrying a rich or potentially rich woman. Now, Jamie may not yet be rich, but he held land, and there was much to hope that it would be full of tenants who would pay rent one day. And this made me, well, I didn't laugh out loud, but I wrote, ha, 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 ha. Okay, quote, and Brianna was Jamie's only natural child, unquote.
As far as he knew.
That's true, but it still made me laugh. And of course, Jocasta was wealthy too and wanted to make Bree her heiress. So Bree potentially has got like, she's like a double heiress here, if you will.
Yeah, but one of them has yet to come to pass. No, Jamie just has the potential.
Yes.
The potential to be wealthy. He is not wealthy currently, whereas Jocasta is currently wealthy. However, now with a husband, if the husband outlives her.
Yeah, but but Brianna will, unless something happens to her, will still outlive Duncan.
Yeah, but Duncan could do what he wants with it after that.
Oh, like squander it?
Or yeah, spend it all.
On whores.
Release all the people. Who knows?
Just kidding. And since there is likely no kids to come from Jocasta and Duncan, Duncan thinks to get some stuff as far as a wedding present himself. He's a bit of a romantic, but romantic may not be the word in this case. He cares for Jocasta, and he is going to get some velvet and some get the stuff to be able to have a lavender pillow made for Jocasta to help with her headaches. And in the end, Roger says, screw it. And he goes over to a different wagon, a different peddler, and looks to see exactly what his very meager funds will buy in terms of a ring. And he gets her something that he says he thinks will like discolor her finger right away. But well, all the better to mark her with something of his own.
I disliked that.
The marking part?
Yeah, I disliked that.
Yeah, I understand why. Jopi writes, the gathering marks the entry of the Fraser's Ridge community into the wider world. And so it is Roger's as well. He is on a journey to find his place in this new world. And his music is a bridge to finding finding part of it. The nickname, I hope I don't butcher it too much. The nickname Shmorach or Smorach, he has been given is a sign of this. We know, for example, that Jamie has a tendency to rename people he cares about. Cultural sensitivity issues of Willoughby aside, on the rare occasions he speaks about Wentworth. He rarely, I think, if ever, uses blackjack, but as a rule, the enemy, Bonnet, Saint-Germain, or anyone else are referred to by their actual name. A nickname is a sign of affection and familiarity. I suspect it's the same in many other cultures, but as an Australian with a strongly English and Scottish influenced society, the nickname is an important social convention. To be given a nickname is a sign of acceptance within a group, and it appears that this moniker of Rogers hasn't been given by Jamie, from whom he is still seeking full acceptance. That's interesting. Joby continues. Rogers' shopping trip with Duncan brings to the forefront a clash between the practical and the romantic, that seems to characterize Roger and Bree. The romantic, more masculine desire to give his bride a ring, an impulse he recognizes as somewhat of a primitive need to designate her as his with his ring, perhaps a ring not provided for by the largesse, albeit well-meaning largesse of his father-in-law. The times they lived in have allowed Bree to follow her engineering, practical side, and Roger his academic, romantic side, without comment or impact on how they relate to their world. Now, Bree is having to examine her more feminine, motherly aspects, and seemingly adjusting pretty well to much of the 18th century, thank you genetics and Frank Randall. Roger has chosen to learn to be a colonial-era farmer. No surprise, perhaps, in the face of doubt and uncertainty, he yields to the romantic, his familiar way of being. I think being presented with a floral chamber pot as a wedding gift, useful as it may be, would bridge too far, even for practical-minded Brianna. She continues, it is also an interesting insight into the relationship between Duncan and Jocasta. Affectionate and considerate, no doubt, and well done to Duncan for finding a gift that is both practical, beautiful, and considerate. Both Duncan and Roger have flipped the romance novel trope of the poor but virtuous woman who gets the rich hero. Whilst the poor woman is deemed worthy for her personal virtues, the poor man must miraculously come into money before being worthy of his love. Duncan, using a title to describe his fiancée, Miss Jo, while she uses his first name, reinforces the role reversal. It's good to see the two men marrying into the Fraser Mackenzie Cameron family, finding connection in their doubts and fears. The chapter ends with Roger having decided on the ring, quoting Genesis 2:24. Being a Presbyterian of long standing, the Bible translations most likely to have been used in the 1960s or 70s have the active lever as the man, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother. I haven't found which translation Roger is using. If it's from another version that I haven't found, if it's a misquote, or in this instance, a deliberate misquote to justify his irrational or romantic, if you and Roger prefer. Susanna M. writes, I'm always surprised when POV, I'm using a new word learned from previous Outlander pod episodes, changes from Claire to another character. It's an interesting fact that this is the first chapter in the book that is not from Claire's point of view. One might expect to get Brianna first because she's the bride or the daughter, but the author chose Roger for some reason. In this chapter, both the grooms from the story, Roger and Duncan, get together to talk about gifts for their brides. Being a romantic character, I was expecting that Roger would think of something like that, but I didn't expect that from Duncan, especially since we all know he didn't marry out of love. I thought it was so sweet of him to take time to notice Jocasta's headaches and decide to give her a gift of a lavender pillow to relieve her pain, since his mother had the same problem. Roger was also very sweet. His train of thoughts was so cute, thinking that she would enjoy something practical, but then deciding on a very poor ring that would mark her finger green even if she took it off. I found this funny, even though it might seem like he was marking his male territory. This simple gift reminded me of Claire and Jamie. Brianna has been wearing her father's ring, but Roger wants to give her something of his own, just like Jamie did when they got to Castle Leigh. Claire was also wearing Jamie's father's ring, but he wanted to give her his own ring, something that would be from him to her and no one else's. Roger doesn't have a lot of money. The money he has was probably still earned while working at the Gloriana, and so he had to buy something really simple. This makes me wonder what he would buy her if they were back in their own time. Roger hasn't completely realized how his family is going to make a living. He used to be a respectful history professor. He didn't have wealth, but he did okay. In the present situation, he doesn't have money and he doesn't have the appropriate skills to make money. He and Brianna are not in equal scales when it comes to making a living in the 18th century. Not only is Brianna more skilled, she is also himself's daughter. When he starts realizing that, like Duncan, he may be marrying a potential woman of wealth, and then others might think that of him, he doesn't like it. Now, a very simple way to look at this chapter's title would be to think that it's only about palpable gifts, tangible gifts of Roger and Duncan giving their brides before their wedding, but it is also about the gift of devotion that both are showing for trying to be thoughtful toward their future wives. And finally, another thing to take note of, and that has nothing to do with gifts, is the fact that Duncan goes to Roger to tell him his secret. He is a Protestant, just like Roger, and not a Catholic like everyone seems to think. This disclosure is interesting because he has decided to discuss this specifically with Roger. It shows the respect Roger is beginning to get from family and friends. I think it's important to Roger to feel his opinion is valued and trusted. What did you think of Duncan? First of all, not telling Jamie or Joanna, Jocasta about not being Catholic.
I mean, it doesn't. I don't think that in that instance it really matters. They don't go to church.
Oh, yeah.
There's not like a church in the neighborhood. So it's like, it's not like they're going to get up on Sunday and go to different churches. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not having kids that need to have any of those things. So it just seemed more out of practicality that he didn't say anything.
Oh, I see. Why he didn't say anything till now at all.
Yeah. And then he divulged his secret to the one person who is not in the center of that family pack. So he's in the same boat. He's joining the family. And this is the one person who's in like exactly the same boat as him. So he would understand. You know what I mean?
I got to say, before I reread it, I forgot that Duncan was a Protestant. Because like you said, it really, I don't think it's much of a spoiler or any of it of a spoiler to say that it's not just like it wasn't really a big deal. It's not a big deal going forward, right? Mm-mm. So it really doesn't come up. I think that's why I forgot about this scene. Because there's nothing to really reference it as far as Duncan is concerned. Duncan and Jocasta later on.
And that was chapter 4. Moving right along to chapter 5, Riotous Unrest.
In case you have not been keeping up, we're still at the final day of the gathering.
Oh my God.
Claire is at her surgery still. A man brings in his injured dog. He believes that the dog was injured in a fight with a raccoon, and Claire's thinking likely he was like trying to be a little bit too amorous with the animal, not the man, but the dog and the dog to the raccoon. And we get to see how the dog shows Claire just how much he likes her. Oh, fun. It was Murray who would end up helping her with the dog by holding the dog's head. So I thought it was very... It was very nice of him because Brianna was gone.
That guy was it, but the owner was a douchebag.
Kind of, yeah.
I'm like, first he just like dumps his dog up there unceremoniously, and he's like, "Fix my dog, help my dog." But then she's like, "Hey, can you hold his face so I can work on this?" And he's just like, "I don't have time to even entertain anything you're saying. You don't exist anymore."
And right before she's done, I'm guessing she's stitching him up. Right before she's done with the final knot or the final stitch, the dog leaps off the table and Claire, BA that she is, tackles it, finishes the sutures, and done. That was pretty amazing, you gotta admit. Next, a gentleman patient, and I don't mean by that, I don't mean male, I mean like someone who's not as poor as the rest of these people, assumingly. He's got a pain in his arm, but he's got some other, he's got as the further that Diana like discusses or describes his injuries and Claire is examining him. Dude's got stuff. He's got a lot of injuries there. And the injuries, oddly enough, I don't know how she, I wonder if it was kind of tongue in cheek. Like there's no way, I don't think, to a specific date that you can look at something and say, oh, okay, you got this injury 3 weeks ago. Now, if you're looking at the coloring of a bruise or, you know, that you can guesstimate, like I could accept a doctor like Claire or someone saying, you know, this looks to be about between week 2 and 4 of healing. Like I do believe that there are landmarks, benchmarks that doctors, you know, people in the know, people who are trained professionals know approximately how much healing and how fast a body can heal. I'm not disputing that. But at first I wondered, dang, she's good. And then I thought, oh, I wonder if she, because she put two and three together really quickly, right? She knew that, because he said he was from Hillsborough. But I'm wondering if she's like, okay, so I know exactly how old these are. These are 3 weeks old. Duh, riots. So the dude had a lot going on, and he had broken teeth. He had just, he was in a lot better shape than maybe other people who had been, you know, or at least a few other people, his friend, namely, and a judge or a justice. But anyway, he had gone out into Hillsborough to help a friend or help defend a friend, and he became caught up in the mob. His friend was named Edmund Fanning, and who'd been appointed postmaster of the colony, but then had resigned, and he was still unpopular. He'd gone to help out his friend. Fanning had been dragged bodily through the courthouse, and like as they went up the stairs or down the stairs, I forget which direction it was, like his head literally like hit every single stair. Like just reading that made me kind of, and he said he could hear it. I mean, that makes me sick. That I can't believe that. And he wanted to go help his friend. And then when he got to him or close to him, that's when the mob set up on them. And so he's got a lot of injuries. He came here and she's doing the best she can. She is able to reset his arm to free his tendon from the oleocranon and the ulna. Like there's, it's one of the joints in the elbow. Anyway, she is able to do some doctoring and free the tendon. And then she wants to go and remove his halfway broken tooth, remove what's left to free him from pain. And she gives him some whiskey to cheer him up a bit and to numb the tissue. And just before she pulls the tooth, she's like, Brianna, you can go. I've got this. It's all good. And she's like, are you sure? She's like, yeah. So she tells Brianna to go. And then Claire finishes up with the patient in front of her.
Because it is her wedding.
Exactly. Right. It's like the least she can do.
I'm like, you know what?
You helped me. You already helped me deal with the sympathetic vomit. So you can go. Leanne F. writes, the fire across his longest day continues with Claire at her morning surgery. This portion of the book makes me feel like we are living through the entire day with the Frasers. Okay, hint, we are. As they would have experienced it from one moment to the next. We don't often get to have this sort of insight into the lives of our characters, so it is very interesting to see them all go about their business on the last eventful day of the gathering, as we get to tag along with them. Claire's surgery, part deux. The stinky man with his injured dog provides a bit of comic relief. The man doesn't seem to be part of the gathering. That's true. He seems to have wandered up and he's like, that's people are in line who are in pain. I can do that. I'm like, that was funny. He seems to have wandered up and is taking advantage of the circumstances to get his dog seen by Claire. The incident also provides Claire with a bonding experience with her medical rival, Murray McLeod, as they both work tag team to subdue the dog long enough for Claire to sew him up. The stinky man offers no thanks and no payment in exchange for their efforts and just wanders off from whence he came.
I was laughing when Davina introduced this dude because they're like, he smelled like a dead raccoon. And I thought to myself, what is so specific about a dead raccoon that was the specific dead animal that was chosen in that description? Because, I mean, if she'd said like a dead skunk, that has a definite smell.
Oh, sure.
But like I don't know that a dead raccoon would smell much differently than like a dead squirrel or a dead deer. I don't know. They don't seem to have the same, or they don't seem to have like scent glands or anything that I know of. I am not a raccoon expert. I think I need to point that out before I go any further into this.
Summer, you're disappointing all of us because we thought you had that credential behind your name.
No, I like to call them trash pandas, though. Yeah, that's all I got. But that struck me. I was like, really? A dead raccoon? That was very specific.
So the next person who comes up, this is Leanne F. continued. The next person coming up is a gentleman, Mr. Goodwin of Hillsborough, who has also somehow found his way here unexpectedly, perhaps. He, too, seems to be seizing the chance to be tended to by Claire, for his multiple injuries suffers previous to the gathering. I think Mr. Goodwin is here to make the strife and unrest that we hear about happening somewhere else real to us and declare. This man brings news of the riotous unrest to the gathering and makes the violence and human suffering real and immediate as we see the damage done in the lingering injuries and scars Mr. Goodwin bears upon his face and body. He has knowledge of the rioters firsthand and provides the other side's testimony of the political situation unfolding between the government and the regulators. The political turmoil is coming closer, and Mr. Goodwin represents one of its casualties. The unrest is no longer just words on a page, but made real in the flesh of Claire, for Claire and the reader. Somewhat ironically, I believe the friend Mr. Goodwin was attempting to rescue was the same Mr. Fanning that Claire performed surgery on at the theater in Wilmington in season 4. Huh. Sounds like Mr. Fanning might need her help again after the mob's treatment of him at Hillsborough. Huh. We'll have to see. Claire, furthermore, or later on, Claire uses, oh, I'm going to say it wrong, Kajaput. I got to look it up. I can't guess at that because that's too far off. It is Kajaput. Okay. Claire uses Kajaput ointment on Mr. Goodwin. I have never heard of it before, so she looked it up. Thanks, Leanne, for sharing. She shares a link for Kajaput oil, which we'll share. And in brief, Kajaput oil is produced by steam distillation of fresh leaves and twigs of the Kajaput tree and the paper bark tree. It is used to treat colds, headaches, toothache, and tumors, to loosen phlegm so it can be coughed up as an expectorant and as a tonic.
All right. And that, my friends, was chapter 5. Join us next time when we will be discussing chapter 6, entitled For Auld Lang Syne. And also, if you want to join and be a contributor for our The Fiery Cross read-along, you can go to our Facebook page. It is an event. It lives in an event on our main page. And if you go, there is a link to a Google Sheets page. It's like an online spreadsheet where you can see the available chapters to choose from. Just message me. Let me know what chapter you want, and I will put you down. And we will be, I think we have the first part up right now, and we'll be releasing more chapters probably in the next, what would you say, the next few weeks?
Yeah. It'll be, I'll always check back if it, if you're in Facebook, on Facebook, the best thing, if you're in our group, it's a saved post, but you still have to go to the main event, which is on our public facing Facebook page. But if you're in Facebook, go to our page or click on it in the group, look at the image, or sorry, go to the link that Summer just mentioned, see what's available and choose one that you like from what's available, if there's one you want to, and just comment on the event and Summer will take care of you and she'll add you and let you know once you're added. And yeah, once soon we will be adding the next section or sections actually. So as always, you can help us continue the conversation by joining our Facebook community. You can join us at outlanderpod.com/group. And thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. And yeah, this is Shimmerin Toots signing out.
I wanted to make a fart noise, but for some reason I just forgot how.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.